Mike Leonard, I'm sure, went to some, well, certainly some Bulls games at the old stadium, didn't you, my friend?
Oh, of course, buddy. Yeah, I got to go to a number at the Madhouse on Madison. I actually liked that stadium even better than the current stadium. It was just way more old school and intimate, I thought, and so loud when you could get the crowd going. It was amazing.
I'm sure it was like one of those old buildings. Like, we used to work in the Tribune Tower for so many years, which was this gorgeous architecture. We had the Showcase studio right there on the first floor. But then you'd get cockroaches and rats. So, I mean, like, there's reasons for change sometimes, as sad as that can be. And but, yeah, the old building was something.
I got to play, John, my claim to fame is I got, and I think it was about seventh grade, got to play in a Pepsi Hot Shot competition at the old stadium. So that was my most exciting moment as an old stadium lover.
Wait, what do you mean by that? What was that?
You're too young. But
no, I'm not.
Back in my day, mm-hmm. they would have these local competitions for basketball. It's called Pepsi Hot Shot. They'd play this bad Pepsi song. And you'd have, I don't know, 30 seconds or a minute to shoot from different spots on the floor. And so you would, you know, you'd go to your local park district. If you won there, then you get to advance to some other park district. And ultimately, if you kept advancing, you get to go play in the Bulls court. So that was my claim to fame as a junior high basketball player.
Well, how'd you do at the court at the stadium?
Horribly.
Oh, really?
absolutely horribly. Those rims are, at least back in the old day, were so tight, and I was probably tight, but I was horrible. So I got there, but I really sucked, John. So
yeah, that's okay. That's okay. I'm glad it's a wholesome memory for you, Mike Leonard. But yeah, no, it'll be a lot of fun tonight. And we did a whole, I'll have to send this over to you, Mike. I think you'd appreciate it, even though you're more of a Bulls fan than a Blackhawks fan. But they did a real cool documentary about the Madhouse. And it obviously has allusions to both the Bulls and the Hawks there, too, about the architecture, why it was built the way it was built, its legacy, cool things they did in the building. It's available on YouTube through the Blackhawks page. And I'll have to send it to you, and I'll post the link as well on my Facebook page, Mike. It's a real good watch.
Yeah, well, the good thing about that building is that really cool events have taken place there over the centuries.
Yeah.
You know, like, wasn't there there was like the presidential.
Oh, how many conventions were there, for sure?
Conventions, yeah. And like anything from conventions to the circus to famous people to concerts. I mean, just pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think it was also, I mean, the Wirtz family was big on the creating of Ice Capades, which debuted at Sonia Henning at the old Chicago Stadium, too. So there's a lot of cool history of that building, and of course, right next door, and there's some odes to it at the United Center, and it's a great building. I love the United Center. It's not, I don't just say that because I work there. It's a building that does not feel 30-some years old now, Mike. They've really done a great job keeping it up. It is Canaveras. It is huge. When you go to other arenas like in St. Louis or Milwaukee, nothing wrong with those places, but Mike, the United Center just has a little gravitas still that the other buildings don't quite have. It's a barn. It's big.
Yeah, I totally agree. We've been, my son and I, and actually some of my daughters too, we've been to various games from Orlando to Indy to other cities to, I've even went to Denver Nuggets game recently. But yeah, the Chicago, I still want to call it Chicago Stadium, United Center, still stands up or is in better than most of the places I've been, that is for sure.
Yeah, for sure. You want to just talk about this for an hour, Mike? We could do it.
Yeah, I mean, we would have, you know, we would have two listeners, but yeah, it'd be great.
312-91.
I do have a shout out.
Oh, go ahead.
To a whole new group of listeners. There's a group called HOFF, HOFF, which is a kind of a men's workout group / camaraderie club / drink beer together club.
Okay.
And they're listening allegedly today. So
oh, boy.
We got you know. So now we have 14 listeners, John.
Oh, oh wow, Mike, you're doing me. You're gonna get me off the air if we keep on saying this. Mike Leonard is a federal defense attorney in addition to being. A big basketball fan. I was going to say something insulting, decided against it, Mike. But you do a lot of great work, and how you been lately? I mean, have you been busy with a bunch of cases, or do things slow down for you around the holiday time?
It never seems like it does. It seems like you got to get to about the couple days before Christmas, and then everything definitely kind of comes to a halt from now until maybe that first Monday in January. So I'm always looking at the calendar to, like, what is the December date where things will get great, and I'm pegging that around December 22nd, so I'm hopefully that happens. But no, we've been extremely busy. The week started with an appellate court argument in federal court on Monday, which is kind of a rough way to start the week. But, you know, the stress of getting ready for an appellate argument and standing before three judges who can ask you whatever they want, whenever they want during the argument is always kind of nerve-wracking.
Was this the Seventh Circuit?
Correct, yes, Seventh Circuit in Chicago. So it was a very professional and nice panel, so it wasn't scary once I got going, but I just hate the stress that leads up to that. I'd rather literally go to trial every day of the week than do appellate arguments. It just gets that level of anxiety in me for some reason.
Do they, are they like the Supreme Court where they interrupt you mid-chatting and ask you questions and pepper you with questions?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, like, you have a time allotment. Like, this case, we had a limited time allotment. Like, in criminal appeals, they tend to give you less time. So we each side had 10 minutes, which is not very long. And there's a running clock in front of you that you can see. So you start out and, you know, you could be anywhere in your argument. You could want to address a particular point, but it doesn't matter. They can just stop you and ask you, any of the three can ask you whatever they want, whenever they want. And, of course, that's eating into your time. So you have this idea that, hey, here's all the things I want to say, but you might not get much time to say those things. You got to be responsive to, directly responsive to whatever they ask and, you know, trying to hold your ground and fight back in response to the questions.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who listens to a lot of oral arguments at the Supreme Court, I love it. I think it keeps it more interesting. And I like that at any point, it does kind of derail the lawyers, though, at certain points and take them on different tangents. That's got to be quite a tap dancing skill that you all have to be able to do that, to return back to your points or just ride the wave of wherever the justices go. But I appreciate it because I like the instant, wait, hold on here, that the justices have the power to be able to do.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, the fact that, you know, you may have this preconceived idea of how the argument's going to go or what the particular questions you anticipate them asking. They may have no interest in those at all. And you can also kind of tell sometimes by, in a very obvious way, by the tenor of the justice or the question that's posed to you, which way they're going.
Yep.
And also a lot of times they're just asking the questions for the purposes of, you know, getting you to make an admission to something which undermines your argument and your position. So sometimes you have to be careful. You know, you can't, deny or things that are just, you know, common sense. But, you know, sometimes you're kind of fighting your ground while trying to admit or deny something. So, it's definitely a tap dance for sure.
Yeah, I often feel that when I listen to the oral arguments, like, look, the justices just want you to admit here that this is a little flawed logic that you're using. Doesn't necessarily mean that the whole case is lost for you, but they want you to admit maybe a little, expose you a little bit on what your argument may be a little bit short. I kind of like that.
Oh, no doubt. And, you know, it depends what court you're in. You know, there's a variety of levels of interest by the justices. You know, you can be in the Illinois Appellate Court. You could be in the Federal Appellate Court, Seventh Circuit, or somewhere else in the country. And kind of how they act and their demeanor and how they treat you is different. And, you know, that varies. You know, you might show up that morning and see who your panel of judges are, the three, and you might, you know, put a little dagger in your heart because, you know, one of them persons is known to be real tough on lawyers or, you know, dismisses a lawyer. So that goes into your thought process too. Kind of a sigh of relief sometimes when you see you don't have people that you don't want to see. And then sometimes the other way, you know what I mean?
Yeah. We're chatting with Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney. Have you ever, I think I asked you this once. I don't think you've argued in front of the Supreme Court. Have you ever gotten close? Have you had cases appealed up to the Supreme Court, Mike?
Yeah, we've tried on occasion, you know, federal criminal cases in particular and state criminal cases often raise constitutional issues, you know, about due process and you know, Sixth Amendment cross-examination issues and all sorts of things. So they're right for raising issues. But again, you know, the Supreme Court takes a small percentage of cases each year. I don't know if it's 3% or 2% or whatever it is. So we've had instances where we've attempted to get them to take our case and been denied. So I've never had a case where they've actually agreed to take it up. But yeah, that would be awesome to have that experience.
So you want to do it. As scary as that might be, as nervous as that be, you'd love to argue in front of that court.
Oh, yeah. It'll be a blast. I mean, you might get completely smoked, but it would be a heck of a good time, and the preparation would be amazing. And then, you know, just to have nine people instead of three peppering you with questions would be pretty awesome.
Oh, man. If you do that, you gotta get me a ticket. Get me in the room, okay?
Hey, if they take one of my cases, I will pay your way, John. I'll even drive down there with you.
Wow. Well, drive. No, you're going to fly me first class. You're going to pay my way, Mike.
Car is as good as you're going to get, buddy.
Okay, sounds good. I'm going to put you on hold really quickly. We're going to take a break. I do want to dive into, I think, probably the big legal local story of the week. Towards the end of the week, the terminally ill adults able to take their own lives with medical help. The bill signed by Governor Pritzker. We talked about it after the legislature passed it. I don't think I got Mike's thoughts on it, but I was kind of surprised at how universally, I shouldn't say universally, how the majority of people, at least I've heard from, including people on both sides of the aisle, seem to really appreciate this. 312-981-7200, where you stand on this, and I'll get Mike's legal expertise on that. Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney here. And Mike, we got the news in the end parts of the week, I think it was yesterday, in fact, that Governor Pritzker signed a bill into law allowing some adults with terminal illness to take their own lives with medical help. There's a lot of safeguards there. You got to have two physicians say that you're within the last 6 months of life, which is a little nebulous, and I'm curious how that plays out, but that's what the rule says, the law says. And you have to be given the options of being told exactly what the other options are, like hospice and some other things as well. It's called Debs Law. It passed pretty well in the House, but only by 3 votes in the Senate. And Mike, I don't know where you stand on this one, or if you just want to dive in a little bit to the law itself, but it makes a lot of sense to me, and I think that this is an issue that has changed in a lot of people's hearts and minds over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, don't you think also raised a lot of issues with individuals in terms of based upon religion and things of that nature?
Of course.
And, you know, the right to life, the right to die, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I didn't know, first of all, that it took two doctors to say that you were within 6 months of the end of your life. You know, I think the standard is you have to be 6 months from death, which is really tough to call, it would seem like, in a lot of instances, but other instances, not hard to call at all, probably. But it allows them to, you know, assist people in taking measures to take their own life, so to speak. And I think there's lots of people, and I'm in the camp that agree that, you know, sometimes that end of life is so bad and so horrific. And having gone through that with, you know, my parents and other relatives, that, you know, I think that can be something that I certainly can approve of, because I've seen people suffer needlessly, and especially in those last periods of their life. So I would support it myself, but I would think we're raised a lot of questions on religious grounds, ethical grounds, whether the doctor should have that sort of power, all those kind of interesting issues, which I think, but, you know, they cited, did you see the citation that they said 71% of Illinoisans supported it? Do you know where that data?
I don't actually, but that actually kind of tracks with what I've seen. I don't follow these groups, but you know how social media feeds you, like Facebook or Twitter or Instagram posts from people that you have no idea. There's a lot of groups I see, like the "I hate J.B. Pritzker" memes out there, that like their pages dedicated to hating the governor and blasting about it. And then you read the comments, and I have seen so many comments that say something along the lines of like, "I do not like J.B. Pritzker at all, but he is right here." And I do think that there is a pretty broad support among both parties on this, Mike.
Yeah, it seems like there is, which I guess I was a little surprised at, because I thought it would invoke a lot of, you know, religious opposition and ethical opposition and even oppositions to, you know, should we give that kind of authority and power to doctors even? And it'd be interesting to see how, if you had any doctors listening to us, or maybe they're too smart for our show, John.
Yeah, right.
What they would say about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Most people I know that work in the healthcare industry, my sister-in-law is a nurse's practitioner at Northwestern in the neurology department. I probably shouldn't put her on blast here, because this is just her own opinion she shared with me. But like a lot of nurses, they say, or doctors, that they see the horrific situation that some patients are in the last 6 months of their lives, the pain, the real pain that they are suffering, and by virtue then their family members as well. We do this for our pets. It just doesn't make any sense why you wouldn't do it for a human that is fully able to make the decision. That's one other area about this. They have to be coherent and be able to make this decision on their own, which of course does eliminate a lot of folks dealing with Alzheimer's, which is probably one of those diseases where the end of life is so rough. And most of those people, unless it's like a quick moving disease, are not going to be capable of making that decision, maybe unfortunately or unfortunately, depending on your side of things. But yeah, Mike, it raised a lot of ethical questions. I think, Mike, what has changed is with an aging population, so many people who maybe have been against it have witnessed it firsthand. And maybe it's one of those things that unless you see it, a loved one go through the end of life in a tragic and long spread illness, you don't get why people would want to do that to help them out that way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it just like a lot of things in life, unless you experience it, it's hard to you know, make a legitimate judgment of, yeah, I've been now through it 2 to 3 times and I've seen how that is. And, you know, when you go to that hospice stage, which can be days, weeks, or months, you know, from when you're going to die, you know, you can be just in a horrendous situation and it's so hard on that person and those around them that are just suffering, watching that person suffer. So I get it. You know, I think it's going to be interesting. How long do you think it'll take before there's litigation, a litigated case where someone makes the argument that the doctors, you know, did, you know, abuse their trust, you know, and they were doing it without, you know, having the proper information that the person was really going to die within 6 months and it was done for financial, was done for financial reasons or, you know, hospital reasons or something like that. That's going to be really interesting.
Iridian handed me the research, Mike, from Impact Research. Do you think a mentally capable adult patient with an incurable terminal illness who only has 6 months or less to live should have a legal option of medical aid and dying to pass peacefully in their sleep? Yes, strongly is 53%. Yes, somewhat is 17%, for a total, as you said, Mike, of 71% said yes. Only 17% said no. That leaves some 12% of people in the middle. Mike, not only do people support this, they strongly support this.
Yeah, interesting. I thought it would be the strong support. I thought that would be higher than 53%. So it surprised me a little bit. But when you add those two categories together, that is a very significant number. Overwhelming, you would have to say, for most, if you think about most legislation that gets passed, you know. Have you got many comments on the comment line or anyone opposing it?
We definitely did the last time we talked about it. In fact, I think we're getting some right now. Let me read them during the break, Mike, so I can make sense of a long paragraph, so I'm not just reading it on the air here. We'll do that after the break. And I'd love your thoughts, 312-981-7200, if you want to chime in on this. I will say that one thing that we have to watch out for is we've heard in other states, 11 other states, and D.C. does this, where insurance have actually denied hospice in certain states where this is an option, saying, well, you have a quicker way out. And I think, I hope that this bill addressed this, or we have some way of preventing that from happening. Because if someone chooses to stay in hospice instead, that's their right and should be provided as end of care coverage as like everything else. So that is definitely one, I think, a real justified argument the other side used in maybe opposing this or trying to refine it. We'll get to those thoughts and more with Mike Leonard. He's a federal defense attorney. We'll chop up a couple other issues as well. We're taking you till 5 o'clock here today. Mike Leonard here for the next 19 minutes or so. Mike, I just want to finish up the conversation we were having about Governor Pritzker signing essentially the right to die legislation yesterday that had passed through the legislature a couple months earlier. We're getting a lot of support on the text line for it. As we said, it was supported by 71% of Illinoisans, according to Impact Research. A couple of interesting questions, though, Mike. Someone wanted to know, and I did look it up, whether insurance companies, life insurance companies, would still pay it out. They, of course, don't for suicide. So what do you think, Mike? I know the answer. Do you think they will or will not pay out coverage for assisted suicide or right to die?
I think they will pay out, although that would trouble me, too, if they wouldn't. But I would guess that they would have
to. They do in other states, yes, because suicide is a legal definition. And since you don't die by suicide, you are that's not the classification here that they would. For the most part, it seems there haven't been cases in other states, but they do pay out in whole as if you had died of completely natural causes, because in many ways you have, Mike. It's the disease that is taking you and they're just kind of ending your suffering. But a lot of people saying, you know, I strongly agree with the assisted suicide. This is from the 815 for the terminally ill. What the 815 says, what I can't understand is why people that oppose it, they want to deny the rights of others. If they don't agree, then they don't have to do it, them or their loved ones. I was raised Catholic and I still have my beliefs. I do, however, believe that I should not impose my beliefs upon others. And I think that's a common refrain from people that maybe support it as well. They have friends or family that have gone through it. They may not do it themselves or have their maybe discouraged close to loved ones from doing it, but why take that right away from someone else? And I think that tracks.
Yeah, the one thing that really troubled me that you brought up, though, earlier was the statement that insurance companies take in the position that, hey, since you are eligible for this, if two doctors say you're in that position, or think about two insurance company doctors saying you're within that 6-month time frame to say to someone that we're not going to pay for hospice care because you're eligible to die. That's scary. And
yeah.
I hope that's something that does not happen. That really is troubling.
I want to look up specific cases for that. I remember reading that as one of the Catholic Charities organization's beliefs of reasons why not to support this. And at the time, I remember trying to dig and find specific stories of that happening. So I don't know if that was more of a worry potential or whether that had actually happened in other states. And I don't want to speak out of turn. I haven't found a specific example, but I haven't dug. And I could totally see. Look, I'm not going to put it past an insurance company to try something like that, Mike. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, sadly, cynically, I wouldn't put it past a healthcare organization or hospital to try to do the same thing, to try to cut costs, right?
Yeah.
By saying you're eligible to die, we're not going to give you those services because it costs too much money. That's troubling, too. So I guess we'll see how this evolves over the next couple of years. Maybe we plan a show for three years from now, John, and see, you know, do a show on the status of litigation under the law.
Make that note already in 3 years from now. Yeah, she's going to circle that on the calendar in 2028. 847 says, this is a great program. Well, that gets your text to the top of the line. And then they go on to say, why is the enactment date in September and not now? My guess would be with a new law like this, there's got to be some mechanisms in place to prepare doctors, facilities, to have the legal materials brought in to conduct this stuff. I know that must really stink for people that are like, we need this right now. But I do understand why laws sometimes have a lag time before taking effect.
Correct. That seems very common. That seems longer than most, but you would think it would be a January 1 thing or earlier. But yeah, that happens often. So I don't know enough about the legislative process and all as to why they would have a fall enactment date. Maybe there was some infrastructure you have to put in place.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, let's pivot off this because nothing says happy Saturday afternoon than right to die. But it is really important. But you wanted to talk a little bit about more college and university cases that you've been getting. What sort of cases have you been taking on, Mike?
Yeah, so, you know, kind of consistent with our defense-minded practice, we have over the last couple of years and increasing just over the last couple of months, and I don't know what the reason for it is. Sometimes you just get known for handling a certain type of case, so you get more. And then other times there's just more of those cases. So I don't know what the chicken and the egg is, but we've gotten more of these university/college disciplinary cases where, you know, a student may be accused of any form of misconduct that you can possibly think of, from non-consensual sex to stalking, to plagiarism, to AI usage, you know, anything you can think of that's kind of attuned to almost like a criminal allegation, even though you're not charged with a crime. And why I say that is the consequences are often really significant. Like, you could be thrown out of the school. You could be disbarred from the school forever with no right to reapply. You might be on the edge of getting your degree. We've had cases where people are literally weeks or days before getting their degree, and the school says, no, we're accusing this infraction. You're not going to graduate, and we're trying to take away your right to get that degree.
So you defend them in this, I wouldn't even, is it a civil process or is it just a university policy process? You defend them as a lawyer, but this isn't in a court of law.
Yeah, it never starts in a court of law. So what happens is, you know, it would just take any Illinois school, for example, could be private, could be public. Everybody has their own set of processes and procedures as to how they handle disciplinary cases. However, there's a lot of kind of, you know, consistencies about those, which, you know, normally allows you to get a hearing. Okay. And then if you are found sort of guilty of that conduct, you know, then not only will they find you guilty, if they make that finding, they will also have a penalty. And it could be just probation, could be suspension, could be, you know, take a continuing education course, or you could be thrown out of the school, right? And then normally there's an appeal process within that school of whatever the decision is. You know, if they go against you, you have an appeal rights. But probably to a lot of people's surprise, you know, these are not like courts at all. So, you know, they have this hearing, which is kind of like your trial on the misconduct allegations.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually have people come in and speak on your behalf and tell their version of the facts. However, it's very non-attorney focused. So, for example, in the hearing, I would be allowed to be there with a student, but I would not be allowed to cross-examine the witnesses, which is a huge thing. You know, if you think about kind of trying to get the truth out and get all angles covered, you're not allowed to do that at all. So you're there as kind of a representative and an advisor, but you can't do that.
And does anyone get to cross-examine, or is it just they take their statement and then they consider on their own, whoever's administering this hearing, whether they believe them or not?
Yeah, so the hearing panel can ask them questions, but, you know, normally it's very non-confrontational. You know, they're just asking them questions as follow-ups. They're certainly not doing anything that looks anything like cross-examination, and certainly the attorney is not allowed to do it. And also, which is kind of troubling, is that oftentimes the witnesses are not required to appear in person. So they can just give a statement, you know, in writing, which would never happen in court, and it would not be subject to any cross-examination because the person's not there, but yet they're giving facts about, you know, a student and saying things that might get them dismissed from school without being subject to any cross-examination at all.
I could tell you want to put yourself in this hearing more, Mike. I kind of get why they don't allow cross-examination. And, you know, like when you're cross-examining a witness of the federal government in a prosecutor's case, they've been prepared. They know what their testimony is, of course. They've been prepared by lawyers themselves, right? I wouldn't want, like, witnesses to certain things happening on campus to have to retain lawyers to pay money just to get amped up for Mike Leonard coming at them on the other side of things.
Well, you might think about this differently, my friend. When we turn the clock ahead 18, 16, 20 years,
and you're in school, okay.
And they point the finger at him, and then all of a sudden there's this hearing, so-called hearing, and your son doesn't have any of the normal rights you would expect him to have. And I don't believe that just because someone's going to be a witness in a university hearing matter that they have to have a lawyer. They certainly don't. But, you know, why not when it's that important, which is taking away someone's degree, kicking them out of a school, maybe having an enormous impact upon their future employment prospects or the ability to go to school somewhere else, you would hope that there'd be a lot of rights for students, but there aren't. So, you know, our job is really preparing the kid to testify themselves, to give their own statement, to prepare their statement, and, you know, to be prepared to answer the questions they're going to face. But that's very different than getting a real full shot to be a full advocate on their behalf. But it's definitely become very important because I see more and more in these cases where they're trying to either kick someone out or take their degree away. And oftentimes it's a very, gray area. It might be he said, she said about something. It might be an AI or plagiarism issue where the policy about AI usage or whether they really did use AI to their advantage in any way is a really hotly contested issue. So we've just been seeing more and more university cases we've been taking on. But yeah, with the interesting thing about they just run the gamut from anything you can think of, from, you know, sexual allegations to plagiarism to, you know, anything you can possibly think of, which, you know, are kind of attuned to a crime when you're in a university setting because of the consequences.
Yeah, and the consequences are, I mean, if you talk about, you know, graduate here, your reputation's tarnished, you get lost wages. I mean, there are often punishments that are probably as bad as losing a civil case in many ways, if not worse. So I get your inclination of wanting it to be a court of law, but these are not criminal charges, right? These are not civil charges.
Well, sometimes they can lead to criminal charges.
Yeah, right. No, I guess I assume the burden of proof is also not beyond a reasonable doubt for the folks that you're helping out in their cases, right?
Correct. It's like a preponderance, preponderance center, which is just more likely than not. But I feel like, you know, definitely I have the sense from doing a lot of these cases that the hearing panels are certainly, in my view, sort of skewed, kind of institutionally skewed against the student coming in. So I feel like even though it's not their burden to disprove the allegations, I feel like practically it sort of is.
Yeah, and I also get that too. I mean, maybe it's not fair, and it isn't, especially if you have someone that didn't do something, especially if it's a very serious allegation, and they didn't do it, and they're not going to graduate because of it, and they spent all this money and all this time. Man, I'm convincing myself as I talk more on your side. But I guess I get why universities also have standards they want to uphold, and they don't want to gain reputations as allowing certain behaviors. And if you have to raise the threshold of proof needed to kick someone out of your university, or you side on their side or allow them to have defense attorneys, I guess I could see the argument for why the university goes, hey, this is up to us at the end of the day. You're lucky you even get a hearing.
Well, the courts are pretty much on your side because it's tough to take the case after, let's say, you get a bad decision at the university level. It's hard. You can sue. We actually have a case or cases in litigation right now, but the standard is very much favorable to the universities because the courts don't want to have to second guess every decision that's made in a disciplinary matter. So the standard, if you go to court, is did the university act in an arbitrary and capricious manner which is a very high standard to meet if you're the student, to say that they violated that. But, you know, there are cases where you can actually win. So you can go to court. It's just not the usual course after you lose, because, you know, the standard is very, very high in court. But I'm not asking for a full trial.
Yeah.
But I'm asking for more rights, particularly when it comes to, let's make sure the witnesses have to testify live in person. Let's have some form of cross-examination. Can you put me on retainer for your son for, you know, 15 years?
No. Yes, there you go.
Just pay me a small amount every week, John, until then?
No, yeah, you better believe it. Very small, in fact. You're gonna laugh at how small the retainer is.
Almost nothing. Almost nothing, right?
Yes, way less than a retainer he's going to have to wear later on in life. Mike, do they have to be sworn in? Like, there's no penalty of perjury for witnesses or something like this, right?
They're not. There is no penalty of perjury.
Huh.
And typically they're not sworn in, but they're given it an admonishment, like, that everyone's expected to tell the truth.
Yeah.
So that's different than actually,
that's a lot different,
being sworn. Yeah, I agree.
I think I'm coming to your side on this, but not all the way. I don't know if I want, like, a Mike Leonard doing a... You'd have to, like, ask really simple and easy to understand and nice questions, Mike. Not nice, but, like, you know, you couldn't put on the full, you know, federal defense attorney Mike Leonard moment in front of a witness.
Why not? It'll be so much more fun to watch, too, you know?
217 says that these are kangaroo courts that these colleges run, and they really have lasting effects. The defendant isn't allowed to do any defending on themselves at all.
Well, that's a great point. That's one of my points. So you are able to do some defending, but yeah, the rights are completely, the tables are completely turned against you, you know, in a procedural fashion. So I agree with that person. I mean, we have a couple of cases where the person was literally going to graduate the next week.
Wow.
And the school is telling them, no, by the way, we think that in a semester or two ago, we think that you plagiarized or used AI. I mean, that's a crazy. Imagine your reaction, John, to that, if that happened to your kid.
Yeah, and also then, are you even able to present, like, evidence of, like, the software that they use glitching or not being as accurate as they make it seem? Like,
point, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we had one case that comes to mind, which was a successful defense where we showed, like, hey, look, this is entirely unfair because you had 10 sections of the same class. They all had different standards about, you know, to what extent could you even use AI at all to assist you in your research or your presentation. They're all different. Some had no limits at all. Others had no limits, but the professor said there were after the fact, you know. And then we also cited to the university that there's been some major universities, including, like, Duke and some others, who've said, we're not going to use these so-called AI detectors as, you know, as a admissible thing in our proceedings because they're still so unreliable. That's going to change over time.
Yeah.
But yeah, the problem is, in most of those cases, is that there's not a standard set up front about what a kid can do or not do with AI. And of course, it's like, you know, it's like going back to when I was a kid. You could use the world book, John. You just couldn't cut and paste and write word for word from the yearbook, from
right.
the world book.
But, right.
So yeah, this is going to be something that's going to evolve over the next several years.
Do you feel like, and we're running out of time here, Mike, but that your presence helps, even though you can't argue in court like you can in court?
Yeah, it definitely helps because I think number one, you're helping the student prepare. So typically there's a written submission and or a statement where they have the floor at the beginning. So typically they'll be given a certain block of time at the beginning, and that's kind of like their opening statement about the whole case, you know, what happened, what they did. So you're keenly involved in that. And then I think, you know, sometimes it is effective to have an attorney because there is that kind of implicit threat, like, you know, hey, guys, we will sue if you don't handle this right way, and we have.
Right, so and
I
also
think
that we
think that's important.
And that we stand by this young man or young woman. Okay, we got to go, Mike. So if people want to reach you out for that, you do some of those cases and much bigger ones as well. What number can people reach you at, Mike Leonard?
312-380-6559. And I can't believe we're on the air today, John. We should be thinking about Bears-Browns tomorrow. Not
I know.
Talking law.
I know. But we're out of time. We'll talk Bears-Browns or something else afterwards. Mike Leonard, take care, my friend.
Take care, buddy.
All right.
Thanks.
He had a couple questions for me, and I skipped right over him. All right, we're going to take a break. We got news coming up, then two more guests here, and let's get legal on WGN.